So we finished this morning thinking about that exclamation, "The Lord has risen. The Lord has risen." Jesus' resurrection, we said, demonstrates that he's Lord, even over death. And because he's Lord over death, we said, he will one day raise us from death. And that's what we're going to think about for a while this evening, us being raised, our future resurrection. I hope that the R word is one of your favorites. I hope that it often is on your mind, not just the H word, heaven, but this more precise word, this more penetrating word, this more illuminating word, resurrection. It's the distinctive note, isn't it, of a Christian funeral. Other funerals go on about heaven and about eternal happiness and that kind of thing. They do so groundlessly, of course. They do so in a monstrous expression of wishful thinking, but they do so. Resurrection, on the other hand, it can't be sentimentalized and evacuated of all substance and turned into saccharine claptrap the way that heaven can. And so you don't hear this word in the inane poems that are read at crematoriums up and down the country. This is our word. It's Christians who want their funerals to be punctuated with references to resurrection. Our claim is unique. Our claim is not simply we shall live forever. Our claim is not we shall flutter about eternally as angels. Our claim is bigger and bolder than that. Our claim is we shall be resurrected. We shall be resurrected. I hope if you're a Christian, you consciously and exuberantly make that claim. But what I'm going to do this evening is present you with three other ways of saying it. Three other ways of saying we shall be resurrected. Three figurative or pictorial ways of saying it. We shall be resurrected isn't figurative. It's a plain, literal description of what is going to happen. But the rising of our bodies on the last day can be described figuratively. And the Bible, indeed, sometimes does so. It uses pictures to convey this event. Not always, of course. On plenty of occasions, it just straightforwardly comes up with the R word. But on other occasions, as I say, it opts for pictures instead. And they are beautiful. And they are helpful pictures. So we're going to take a look at them. We're going to consider three pictorial ways of saying we shall be resurrected. And first of all, then, we shall be wakened. We shall be wakened. Being wakened from sleep is one way that the Bible pictures resurrection. This imagery, it made it into that hymn that we sang just now. You may or may not have noticed. Soon shall come the great awaking. Soon the rending of the tomb. Wow. There aren't enough lines like that, are there, in our hymn book that are spine-tingling in their description of Resurrection Day? It's an Old Testament phenomenon, actually, this depiction of resurrection as a wakening. You'll sometimes hear people say, oh, well, resurrection is a New Testament truth. They didn't know about resurrection in the Old Testament. That's nonsense. You remember how Martha said to Jesus about her dead brother, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. Where'd she learn that? She'd never read 1 Corinthians 15 or 1 Thessalonians 4 because they hadn't been written yet. And she hadn't witnessed Jesus' resurrection and made an inference from that because Jesus hadn't been resurrected yet. No, she'd learnt about resurrection on the last day from the Old Testament, or if not directly from the Old Testament, from teachers who themselves had learnt it from the Old Testament. Resurrection, I'm saying, is part of Old Testament revelation. To be sure, it becomes clearer this side of Easter Sunday and in the writings of the Apostle Paul in particular, but nonetheless, resurrection is part of Old Testament revelation. And one way that the Old Testament reveals the truth of resurrection is through this image, I'm saying, of waking, wakening. You get it fleetingly and tantalizingly in a couple of the Psalms, but most notably, you get it in two prophetic texts, one in the prophecy of Daniel and one in the prophecy of Isaiah. Here's how Daniel puts it, Daniel 12, verse 2. Many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake. You can't miss there the reference to death, can you? Genesis 3:19 is very obviously in the background of that verse. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. These people in Daniel 12 verse 2 aren't sleeping in the dust in the sense that they're camping out in the desert for a night or something. They are sleeping in the dust in the sense that their bodies have become dust. They have disintegrated in death. These are dead people Daniel is talking about. That's the kind of sleep that he means. And from that sleep then, from the sleep of death, they will, he says, be wakened. Of the three pictures that we're looking at this evening, this is the one that most emphasizes continuity. You might wonder what I mean by that. Well, the other two pictures that we're going to look at could give the impression that our present bodies are going to be dispensed with and replaced, like when you trade in your car. And the car that you drive away from the garage in is, of course, a completely different vehicle from the one that you've left behind there. But resurrection isn't like that. That's not how God works. God is the ultimate conservative, and that's not a political statement. I'm not saying that he favors Rishi Sunak over Keir Starmer or anything like that. I'm saying he's a God who conserves. It isn't his way to write things off and start all over again, but rather to work with what is already there. So the creation itself, when Christ returns, is going to be, Paul says, liberated from its bondage to decay. Not it's going to be destroyed and replaced. No, God is going to work with this creation and liberate it so that it is beautiful and glorious and all the rest of it. And similarly then, he's going to work with these bodies that we have right now. And as I say, this particular picture then that we have in Daniel 12, it emphasizes that. To waken someone, just in an ordinary sense, on a morning, to waken someone is to waken the very same person who has been asleep for 8 hours. And when God wakens our bodies then, he will waken the very same bodies that have been asleep for 8 years or 8,000 years or however long it may be. Actually, the wakening text that I really like is the Isaiah one. It's Isaiah chapter 26, verse 19, where we read these words, "Your dead shall live, their bodies shall rise. You who dwell in the dust, awake and sing for joy, for your dew is a dew of light, and the earth will give birth to the dead." There's something very homely about the imagery there. It makes me think of a parent going into the child's room and saying, "Wake up, it's morning," and kind of vigorously opening the curtains to let the light come streaming in order to demonstrate that it's morning. And here, along with this cry, "Awake," in the middle of the verse, there's that line, "For your dew is a dew of light." That's literally correct, but I think the NIV probably is on the right lines when it says your dew is the dew of morning. And I think then that God is saying to our bodies on that day, "Wake up, it's morning. Can't you feel the dew? It's not sleepy time anymore." And link that then with that common biblical theme. We've touched on it recently in 1 John. Of this present age being night, and the age to come being day. And it's in the night then, in this present age, that our bodies suffer, isn't it? They get old, they get cancer, they get heart failure, and so on. This present age is a torrid time for our bodies. So that it's as if then, as he wakes them on resurrection day, God kind of reassures them, it's okay. You can get out of your bed in the dust. It's morning. The night's over now. There's not going to be any more suffering. You can get up. Everything's fine. And connected with that, I love the picture in the middle of that verse of our bodies waking and immediately launching into song. On that great morning, of course, the whole creation will sing. Then shall all the trees of the forest sing for joy, Psalm 96:12. The rivers will clap their hands and the hills sing together for joy, Psalm 98:8. And our bodies, this verse is saying, will join in that great chorus. And one other thing that strikes me in Isaiah 26:19 is the first line, which in Hebrew actually says, your dead shall live, my body shall rise. You can see why the ESV changes it, because it sounds so queer, doesn't it? My body shall rise. This is God speaking, and he says, my bodies shall rise. But again, it feels to me somewhat parental in its tone. I mentioned a moment ago the parent going into the bedroom with great vigor, pulling back the curtains and all the rest of it. But now turn the clock back an hour. And the mum is already up, but it's not yet time for the children to be. But at one point then she kind of creeps into their bedroom just to look at them sleeping. And she smiles as she does so. These are mine, she thinks. And in a little while, I'm going to wake them up. And as God looks tonight at the graves of his people, the graves of people who have been part of this church and we remember them so fondly, the grave of Colin Hart, who was buried a couple of days ago, as he looks at those sleeping remains tonight, like that mum, he smiles. Like her, he's all possessive. Mine, he says, of those remains, my bodies. And in a little while, I'm going to wake them up. Well, we must move on, but I hope you'll ponder this beautiful picture then in Daniel and in Isaiah, this picture of Resurrection Day as a great awaking. God, this ultimate parent, this father who will waken his children's bodies. On that great day, we shall be wakened. Secondly, tonight, we shall be housed. We shall be housed. And this then was in the second passage that we read this evening, 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 1. For we know that if the tent that is our earthly home is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. Now, as I said, that could give the impression that our bodies are going to be replaced. I mean, there's no continuity, is there, between a tent and a house. You go on a camping holiday for a week and you then return home. And in no sense then is the house to which you've returned the same accommodation as the tent that you're in during the week's holiday. No, the house replaces the tent as your accommodation now. And this is why, then, biblical pictures must never be pressed too far. They must be used according to their purpose, but not pressed any further than that. And the plain, non-figurative texts in the Bible, which indicate that it's the same body before and after resurrection, they must take precedence over figurative texts like this one that suggest, perhaps, replacement. So 1 Corinthians 15:42-44, for instance, that's a plain, non-figurative text. The body that is perishable is raised imperishable, Paul says, and so he goes on with other similar statements. So there aren't two bodies, one that's perishable that is then replaced by another that's imperishable. There's one body that experiences two different states. Now a perishable state, then an imperishable state. So the point here in 2 Corinthians 5:1 then can't be replacement. It must rather be upgrade. Upgrade. The body in its present state is tent-like, Paul says. It's such a perfect picture, isn't it? We get that, don't we? It resonates with many of us perhaps this evening. I mean, tents are flimsy. They collapse in strong winds. They succumb to wear and tear and become increasingly dysfunctional as poles snap and holes appear and mildew grows. And our bodies are also flimsy. They are prone to collapse. They succumb to wear and tear. They become increasingly dysfunctional. Some of you would perhaps never dream of going camping. You can't stand the idea. You can't think of anything worse. But actually, you know, there's a sense in which your entire life is a camping trip. You spend the whole of it, from conception to final breath, in a tent, because your body is one. Your body is one. And when you're in your 20s and in peak physical condition, it may be a slightly better quality tent than it is later on in life, but it's always a tent and nothing more. But one day it won't be, Paul says. One day it won't be. On Resurrection Day, we shall be housed. Our bodies then won't be fragile and vulnerable and degenerative. They will be solid and robust, like that structure which the third little pig in the story erected, and no wolf could possibly blow it down. Indeed, Paul says here that they will be eternal. That's the word he uses at the end of verse 1. So it won't just be that they'll last an awful lot longer than our present tent-like bodies do, but they will last forever. In their new state, our bodies will last forever. 1 million years after the resurrection, they will still be going strong. 10 million years, 20 million years, and so it goes on. What a thought that is. Bodies that are house-like rather than tent-like. But the transition then from tent to house at the resurrection points, I think, to more than just an upgrade in its material quality. Certainly that's part of what the imagery is getting at. But I think there's more going on than just that. I mean, you can't miss, can you, the echo here of a key transition that takes place within the Bible's story, within the Old Testament story. I mean, does it not ring bells in your mind, a tent being exchanged for a building? Doesn't it take you to the time of Solomon, when a tent, the tabernacle, was exchanged for a building, the temple? That must be in the background here. There are other touches that suggest that as well. The not made with hands is used in the Gospels in connection with the temple. And what then I think Paul is saying here is that our resurrection bodies will not only be strong, he's certainly saying that, but he's also saying they will be holy. They will be temples. In what sense will they be temples? Well, they will be temples in the sense that they will form the setting for unprecedented communion with God. I mean, that's what the temple was primarily about, isn't it? Yes, it was a place where bloody sacrifices were made. But even that was with a view to communion with God. Primarily, that's what the temple was about. Think of that verse with which we began our service tonight. David's longing to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord in the house of God, in the temple. The temple was primarily this place where God was meant to be known and enjoyed. And in our resurrection bodies then, we shall know God and enjoy God like we never have before. You see, our bodies in their present state are really quite poor instruments for communion with God, aren't they? You know that. I mean, these brains of ours, they can only take in so little, can't they, that we read in our Bibles. and we learn something on the Lord's Day, and by Thursday afternoon, we've completely forgotten what we learned on the Lord's Day. Our brains are so feeble. These eyes of ours, they get sleepy and heavy when we're trying to pray, and they close as we're trying to pray to our God. These joints of ours, they get arthritic, and the pain makes focusing on God difficult. We're distracted by the aching joints that we have. These taste buds, they lose their sharpness as we go on in life and limit our experience of the sweet, rich wine at the Lord's Supper. And so we could go on with many other ways in which our bodies in their present state, they're poor instruments that often get in the way of our communion with God. As Jesus put it so succinctly, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. That's our bodies in this present age. The flesh is weak and conflicts with that intimacy with God that we want to have in our spirits. But you see, these resurrection bodies that Paul is talking about, they will be these temples. They will be ideally suited for communion with God. That line will be erased forever. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. That won't be a relevant line anymore. Jesus will never say that again in the age to come, because the body, the flesh, will be as willing as the spirit is to pursue after God and will be perfectly designed for knowing God and enjoying God and serving God and being close to God. That, I think, is what Paul is getting at here. And again, what a prospect, baby. What a prospect. Never that desire to pray, but a body that's heavy and tired and just won't let you pray. Never that desire to understand something about God, but a brain that's fuzzy and confused and tired and can't understand this thing about God. But then, our bodies, these wonderful houses, these temples, holy as well as strong. So we're looking at these pictures of resurrection. We shall be wakened was the first. We shall be housed was the second. But then thirdly and finally, we shall be clothed. We shall be clothed. Because it's interesting, isn't it, how that too is here in 2 Corinthians 5. And Paul actually kind of shifts to the clothing imagery when he hasn't actually fully finished with the housing imagery. And so he says there in verse 2, in this tent we groan, longing to put on our heavenly dwelling. Now, putting on isn't really an appropriate verb for a dwelling. It's what you do with a garment. It's what you do with clothes. But that's the direction that he's moving in, because then in verses 3 and 4, he leaves behind the housing imagery and he focuses instead on this clothing imagery. And I think then that this clothing imagery here, there's often quite a bit of confusion surrounding it. And we think then that this kind of transition from being naked to being clothed that Paul talks about can't work in the same way as the transition from being in a tent to being in a house, because we say, well, we're not naked now. We're in a tent now, we get that, but we're not naked now. We do have bodies. And so this nakedness then, some people say, well, it must refer to the situation between death and resurrection, when our souls will be disembodied, our souls will kind of be naked. And that's what Paul is talking about here. But I don't think that is the case at all. I think verse 4 is not particularly helpfully translated in many of our versions. Paul literally says there, for while we are still in this tent, we groan being burdened, because we do not want to be unclothed, but to be clothed. That's simply what he says there. Because we do not want to be unclothed, but to be clothed. So he's saying then that we groan now because now we are unclothed. He's not talking about some strange period between death and the resurrection. He's saying we're unclothed now, and so we groan now. We groan now because we want to be clothed. So that raises the question, well, how are we unclothed? How are we naked now? Well, of course, in the Bible, to be found naked, that's the language of verse 3, i.e. to be exposed to public view in your nakedness, that is deeply humiliating. We read, didn't we, that passage in 2 Samuel. And that's precisely what happened to those servants of David. Remember how David sent them on this very amicable trip to send greetings to another king, and the other king misunderstood, or his servants misunderstood the nature of the trip. And so he humiliated those servants by cutting off their garments from the waist down so that they were naked virtually to public view. And that was deeply humiliating, and David had to deal with that situation. And in what sense then are we naked? Are we unclothed now? Well, in this sense, these bodies of ours are humiliating. That's what Paul is getting at. In that sense, it's like we're unclothed now because these bodies are so humiliating. Paul uses precisely that language, doesn't he? In Philippians 3:21, he talks there about Christ will transform, and I think in our versions it says our lowly bodies, but it's literally the bodies of our humiliation. That's what he says. That's how he describes these bodies in their present state. They are the bodies of our humiliation. They are humiliating things. Similarly, he says, doesn't he, in 1 Corinthians 15, passage I referred to earlier, that they are sown in dishonor, in their present state, in other words. They are in a state of dishonor. He's not just talking about at the moment of death. He's talking about throughout life. There's a dishonorableness about our bodies now. Remember last Sunday morning, those of you who were here then, and we were in 1 John chapter 3. We're children of God, John says. And as such then, as children of God, we should be these bright, shining, dazzling people who wow everyone with the splendor of our appearance. And yet John goes on to say the world does not know us. As we said, no one stops you in the street and says, wow, you must be a child of God. Doesn't happen, because we look so ordinary, we look so bland, we are crumbling and failing just like the non-Christians are. And that's humiliating then, to be sons and daughters of the living God and to struggle to clamber out of bed in the morning, to get to the breakfast table where there's a mound of pills awaiting you. It's a humiliating condition for people who are princes and princesses in the family of the Most High God. That's what Paul is saying. It's humiliating being in this present bodily state. But one day we shall be clothed. One day we won't be like David's men anymore in this embarrassing condition. One day we shall be glorious. Bodies sown in dishonor, Paul says, will be raised in glory. One day, these bodies will be shining and splendid, and just like the body of Jesus himself that so wowed Saul of Tarsus when he saw it on the road to Damascus. And Paul says, doesn't he, in verse 4 here, that we groan then, being burdened. Is that true of you? Or have you just settled for this? Have you just settled for the humiliation of our present bodily state? Paul says, no, we groan, we're burdened until we're clothed, until our bodies are what the bodies of children of God should be. It's interesting to link this as well back to the end of chapter 4, because this is all one passage. And we're very familiar, aren't we, with verse 16 there. Though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day. And that's a precious verse, isn't it? Especially as we get older and as we feel the outer self crumbling, that the inner self doesn't have to be crumbling as well. It can be moving in the opposite direction. It can be getting stronger and being renewed every day. But we miss then perhaps the logic of how Paul continues there. Notice the next verse begins with the word for. For this light momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison as we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal. And Paul then, I think, is saying that this inner renewal of our inner selves now, that happens as and through us gazing upon the glory that is one day going to come upon our outer selves. It's as we fix our eyes on what we cannot yet see, the glory that one day is going to flood our very bodies. It's as we groan and are burdened for that. It's as we think about our future, think about the resurrection. It's as that happens that our inner selves are renewed. These aren't two separate things. It's through the contemplation of our glorious resurrection future that we experience this daily renewal now. And so that's my closing challenge to you, believer. If you're not a believer, my closing challenge is that all of this that I've said to you tonight is irrelevant until you first repent of your sins and come to Jesus Christ and make him your Savior. But if you're a believer tonight, I say to you, are you groaning? Are you burdened? Are you longing? Are you straining? Are you eager? Do you desire this future? Is resurrection a precious concept to you? Because the more it is, the more vitality will flood your soul now. You'll be renewed now, day by day. You'll become stronger in your soul now, day by day. The more you contemplate the resurrection that lies ahead. May we be those who groan and are burdened. Amen.